This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Ryan and Andrew embrace their inner fire bear with Only the Brave and share some choice Halloween season recommendations.
And we're going to kick it off with Joseph Kosinski's Only the Brave. And I have to be honest, considering this was from the director of Tron Legacy, which is one of the worst movies of the past 10 years for me, I was actually pretty impressed by this. And I guess the trailers almost kind of mismarketed this as more of a like a disaster porn type film. But it's really just a really nice character study with a few action scenes, nothing too crazy. But they really work based, the movie really works based on paying homage to these real life heroes, and not knowing the true story going in really helped sell the film for me. I think Josh Brolin and Miles Teller are really the main story here. They're always very reliable actors, but here they kind of give it that the proper gravitas, and you know, there's weight to everything, obviously, because this is based on a real life story, and that kind of helps sell it further. I did have a few misgivings about, you know, some of that I guess I'll call it 90s movie style dialogue. And it's a little too bro-heavy at times, but that's obviously nothing to its detriment. And I think by the time you get to, like, the final 15 minutes of the film, it really just pulls together and makes the whole thing work. So despite any misgivings about individual scenes here and there, including this really heavy-handed metaphor with the aforementioned fire bear, and it's a little bit of a hokey CGI scene, too. But overall, it worked quite well for me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I ever saw Joseph Kosinski making a movie like this after Tron Legacy and Oblivion, the Tom Cruise starring movie, which I didn't even see. Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was an emotionally harrowing experience, and much like you, I didn't really know the story going in, so it definitely helped with the experience. But yeah, I mean, you're definitely right on saying this is a character-driven movie, and I thought it was really well done the way they sort of started these two separate storylines with, you know, Josh Brolin as the sort of fire chief, you know, the head of this unit that fights wildfires, and how they, you know, need to get certification in order to be considered legitimate, and how, you know, they have a really good team of these firefighters, but they always seem to get looked over for opportunities. And then they sort of start the Miles Teller storyline where he's not doing well in life, and then he sort of becomes a part of Josh Brolin's world. And I thought it was really effectively handled. I think a lot of the acting was really the strength. I think Josh Brolin, as always, is really good. I thought Jennifer Connelly was used well in a role that in some movies might be minimized to just, you know, the doting wife role. I thought they gave it actual, you know, context and some weight to the performance, which is obviously fitting for an actor of Jennifer Connelly's caliber. I also really like Miles Teller. I think he's really underrated as an actor. I think, you know, when in the right role, he really brings it, as he did in Whiplash and as he does here. And also, I have to mention, I've always had a soft spot for Taylor Kitsch as an actor, definitely tying from his days on Friday Night Lights TV series. But I'm glad to see him sort of get this nice supporting role where it's sort of comedic. He's sort of playing the guy who sort of starts in contention with Miles Teller, and then they become great friends. And I sort of mentioned before we started recording, my favorite scene in the movie is when they're trying to dote after Miles Teller's daughter in the film or whatever. And it's just one of those sort of, it's a scene that could have been so cliche, and it's a scene we've seen time and time again in other movies, but just based on the way they built up the characters and their sort of insecurities and flaws, I thought that was played out really well.
Definitely. I also want to highlight James Badgdale in this film, who's a guy that really is underutilized in Hollywood. I think he's a very, very good actor, and he just kind of plays second fiddle to Josh Brolin's fire chief here. But he's the kind of guy who can just sell 1,000 words with just like 1 5-second stare. And I kind of wish that there was more from him. I understand the approach that they took with this movie, and, you know, by focusing on the fire chief and Miles Teller's, like, you know, comeback kid who's, you know, unfortunately in recovery for heroin addiction and really just wants to do right by his daughter and hopefully, you know, get in the good graces with his family and the mother of that child as well. I was taken aback by the fact that there was actually very little action in this. And you know, as I mentioned, it's a very, I think the movie was almost mismarketed. And I think people are going to be very surprised going into this and coming out of it. It's really much more effective than I expected it to be. And obviously, you know, not knowing the story going in helps, but they really just kind of, there's one little character reveal pretty much right around I want to say the third turning point, the Dark Night of the Soul moment, if you will, that's when the movie just kind of clicked for me. I know that there's, in the beginning, I was kind of maybe a little hesitant saying, okay, where's this going, you know, that as things are being fleshed out, But there is, you know, a lot of really nice moments where, you know, Miles Teller is, you know, he's obviously established as this ne'er-do-well who really kind of comes into his own and is, and that's really the main selling point of the film for me. And I think it really gives a nice emotional coda at the end of the film when they show, you know, the real life pictures of all the firefighters involved.
I also have to compliment some of the cinematography in the film from Claudio Miranda, a classic cinematographer. But I thought it was really effectively handled, the way they used the fire and the imagery. And obviously you alluded to that sort of a bit heavy-handed thing with the fire bear. But I thought at least even in those sequences, there was some very striking visual imagery that sort of brought the fire to life in sort of very effective ways, which is always obviously helpful in film all about fighting these fires. But yeah, the third act definitely takes that much darker turn or whatever, and it was really you know, it's definitely difficult emotionally on an emotional level, and I definitely got emotional at some points because the film did such a good job with building up these characters and their relationships. And it was really interesting because I thought it was very clever how they, you know, they did it very simply, you know, as most movies do, where they just set up the necessary elements and then they sort of pay off in that third act in sort of unexpected ways. And I thought that was very sort of well done. And I really do sort of like the dynamics between sort of the, you know, the Grant and Matt and Hotshots team or whatever. You know, it does have some of that sort of bro culture, but I mean, I feel like that's there for a reason because it's true to real life or whatever. And I thought some of the playful banter between that, you mean, you alluded to the fact that there's maybe some 90s era dialogue in there, but I thought in context of the movie, and the characters, I thought it worked on a particular level. But I mean, overall, I really, enjoyed the movie. Definitely, one of the bigger surprises for me of the year, because I saw the trailer, didn't really think much of it. And then it ended up getting these, very consistently great reviews or whatever. And then I ended up really enjoying it, which is the first time I can really say that about a Joseph Kosinski film.
I know, and I appreciate the way that they framed the story. I understand that there were like certain beats that they had to hit through the story just to kind of gain that emotional attachment, and it really just does sell it. You know, when there's all this tension around the family members wondering if the firemen are going to live through this. As someone, my cousin is actually a firefighter in Maricopa, Arizona, so this I can say that it is fairly accurate in that the culture and the rapport that firefighters have together. And you know, it's very, I use the term reverence, but I don't want that to sound like it's too heavy-handed with it. There was heavy-handedness in the film, but none of this is like kind of beating you over the head with I guess, you know, for instance, Michael Bay's Benghazi movie about like, oh, this is a you know, fucking hero shot here or there and everything. They really go out of their way to make these seem like normal people, even if they are just kind of broad. Broad caricature might sound like I'm damning it with faint praise, but it's really, they paint a vivid picture about this culture. Obviously, Arizona is basically Phoenix, and then the rest of it is just desert. And they really kind of sold that atmosphere of just how different this town is based on versus the rest of the state. And unfortunately, like we mentioned, it is an unfortunately topical film. So really, you know, just kind of, I have more respect for the story that they were trying to tell. And I hate the fact that it had to be because of these real life events and because of what's going on in California. But it's, and I hate to even call it a diversion, but it really just kind of puts things in the context for you in real life perspective. And that's really the highest compliment that I could pay for the film. So any, you know, misgivings that I have about some of the, you know, the rough around the edges dialogue really just kind of deteriorated by the time we get to these big reveals in the third act.
Yeah, and, you know, just definitely, you know, recommend it. And sort of with that in mind, we'll sort of transition into sort of our main news topic for the day, which is the new trailer for Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, famously starring Daniel Day-Lewis in his supposed last role on screen. We'll see if that ends up being the case. But it definitely seems like a doozy. Anyone who doesn't, you know me all that well knows I'm obsessed with, you know, if you don't know me, I mean, I'm obsessed with Paul Thomas Anderson. He is literally my hero, my icon in the film world. Everything, every film, you know, I watch of his, you know, I watch it multiple times and just obsess, you know, in the build up to one of his films. So obviously I'm really pumped for this. It definitely seems like a change of pace, seems more maybe having some similarities with his previous film, The Master, in terms of at least its approach, in terms of visually from the trailer. I got some of those elements in particular, but it definitely looks like a really intriguing, I mean, you alluded to before, you know, the trailer even got released, that people are talking about as sort of maybe a drier sort of British type of film. Obviously, it's set in Britain, and whereas because, you know, PTA's previous films have all sort of been very sort of American films. So it's going to be really interesting to see his approach. But, I mean, he's such a student of film and such familiar with filmmakers like the likes of Mike Lee and stuff like that. I'm sure he's going to use a lot of his influences and wear them on his sleeve. And I'm also really excited because he's serving as his own cinematographer sort of for the first time. Although, for those of you who don't know, in terms of the master, although Mihai Malam, I don't know exactly how to pronounce his name, is credited as the cinematographer on the master. In reality, Paul Thomas Anderson ended up actually doing most of the cinematography in that film himself. So it's really interesting trivia to note if you didn't know that. But I mean, I'm really pumped for Phantom Thread. It definitely seems like a bit of a change of pace. So I guess I would say there's a part of me that's a bit hesitant because I don't know exactly what to expect, but it's PTA. He's my hero. So I'm expecting it to be great nonetheless.
Exactly. There are definite Mike Lee vibes in the trailer, and I'm a huge, huge, huge Mike Lee fan. So this is really just in my wheelhouse, and the fact that it comes from my favorite, one of my favorite filmmakers, it really just kind of sells it for me. And PTA is a guy who can do no wrong. The guy has never made anything less than an excellent movie, which is really saying something. And we've mentioned before on this podcast that both of our favorite films are from PTA, even though they are both different films, mine being Magnolia, Andrew's being Boogie Nights. The guy just has such an incredible eye for everything. I really loved his collaborations with Robert Elswit in the past, but I actually didn't know that factoid about the master, so that's pretty interesting. So that makes me, and there's definitely stylistic flourishes that are very similar to the master. And what I'm really hoping for more than anything is that Johnny Greenwood finally gets his recognition for doing the score to these films. As I have also mentioned, I am a huge, huge, huge Radiohead fan as well, and even from when he first started with There Will Be Blood, I think it's really the main, I don't want to say the main selling point, but it really is just like, you know, that perfect storm colliding together and making me happy.
Totally. And you sort of brought up that Boogie Nights is my favorite PTA film. And because you brought that up, I feel like I have to comment on another story that made the news rounds this week, where Mark Wahlberg had gave a speech in front of a cardinal or a pope or someone that was a part of the church or whatever. And he said, you know, you said he was sorry for making Boogie Nights. Although I will say in context, I feel like in reality, he's just saying that for the audience he's in front of. I don't really think he believes it or whatever. But Mark Wahlberg, shame on you for dragging Boogie Nights' name through the mud. This is the film that made you a star, damn it, and you should be ashamed for apologizing for it rather than being ashamed for making it, because it's a true masterpiece and you're amazing in it. So, I mean, as I said, I don't really think the comments, they may have been blown out of proportion, or if he's just saying them for the audience he's in front of, but I just felt like I had to comment on that because we're talking about PTA.
Yeah, this is also the same guy who thinks that Max Payne is his best performance, so take what he says with a grain of salt.
And with that in mind, we'll transition into our Halloween season recommendations. And basically, you know, we basically sort of kept it pretty open-ended for ourselves, where we're basically just giving sort of a top five, although in my case, I cheated a little bit, and there's a sort of a top six, as I had a couple films tie for one spot. But basically, we're giving, you know, our seasonal recommendations, either films that might be streaming now that an audience can watch, or films that just get us sort of in the Halloween spirit. So, Ryan, if you want to start out with your fifth Halloween season recommendation.
Well, thank you kindly. I'm starting off with a film. I'll say first of all that every film on my list is on a streaming service of some variety, and I will mention which streaming service it's on just to make life a little bit easier for you. Number five on my list is actually Clive Barker's Hellraiser, which is a film I did not watch until recently. My wife and I watched it the other night, and that's a fucking nasty movie, man. That I had heard all the stories about how gory and like creepy, and how it's the movie's kind of like an homage to the S&M crowd, and it just makes you uncomfortable. It's almost like the screen is melting with all this tension, and the you know, the antagonists, the monsters in this film are really just unnerving to look at. It's incredible makeup work considering it came out in, I think it was 87 or 88. This movie is now currently streaming on Netflix, and if you haven't seen it, or if you only know it, unfortunately, like other horror franchises where the sequels just are diminishing returns, it's really worth checking this out. I will also mention that, you know, growing up, I was always in a constant battle with my devotedly Catholic parents of what movies I could and couldn't watch, and it was always the horror movies that I couldn't watch. This is one instance in which I would probably give him credit for not letting me watch it as a child. I would say it's probably for the 13 and up crowd, but we are also two filmic individuals, so take that with a grain of salt as well.
Yeah, actually, I believe I watched Hellraiser for the first time last Halloween or whatever, and I loved it as well. I was very surprised how good it was or whatever, because I'd always heard sort of interesting things about it, but it's one of those films, horror films, that always fell through the cracks for me. So I'd definitely give it a hearty recommendation as well. But I'm starting my list with definitely more of, I would say, a cult classic, and it's a sequel in a famous Halloween franchise or whatever, but I have to recommend it because I rewatched it recently. And although I will say that all of its elements don't exactly hold up well, this is definitely a sort of a movie that gets me in the Halloween spirit and is much more of a B movie. And of course, I'm talking about Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Now, this is the infamous Halloween sequel that has no Michael Myers. this is like a completely separate story. After the first two entries, you know, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, they wanted to end the story just like that, and they didn't want to make any more with Michael Myers. Of course, audiences ended up being in a fervor about Michael Myers not being in this film, so they ended up going back to the well with 4, 5, and so on and so on. But Halloween 3, Season of the Witch is a rare treat. I will say that, you know, as I said, I rewatched it recently, and you know, I feel like the more I watch it, maybe the less it loses its charm. So you might just want to watch it once or twice, because I'll be honest, not a whole lot even happens in the movie. But one of the reasons I'm sort of recommending it is just, it's, you know, it's weird as hell. Like, you know, there's these Halloween masks that, you know, basically this guy, Colonel Cochran, in this great scenery-chewing performance from Dan O'Hurley. It's definitely the best element in the film, where he has this crazy plan to have these Halloween masks take out the children of the world on Halloween night. And probably the most famous element of the film is the classic Halloween jingle from the commercial, Silver Shamrock, who makes the masks. I'm not going to sing it for you here, but safe to say, if you watch the movie, you're not going to get this earworm song out of your head anytime soon. But, you know, the movie is just so weird. It takes twists and turns that you really can't expect. And as I said, it's not the most exciting movie. Not a whole lot happens. But if you're just looking to watch a weird movie that gets you in the Halloween spirit and does things that are just odd and that don't make any sense, this is the film for you.
Yeah, I remember very vividly watching this film. I was at a friend's house when I was like 13 years old on Halloween, and just a bunch of us were sitting down going through all, you know, any horror movie that we can find. And Season of the Witch was one of those movies, and I very distinctly remember being the only one in the room that actually liked it. And like general audiences, my friends were pretty pissed off about the fact that Michael Myers was nowhere to be found. But getting to number 4 on my list, and I also want to apologize for not mentioning that Hellraiser is now streaming on Netflix. That is Netflix for Hellraiser. Number 4 on my list is Ty West's The Innkeepers, now streaming on Amazon Prime. This is a film that I loved. I just really appreciate it. It's basically innkeepers at this famous hotel in Connecticut that's, you know, haunted, and they're pretty much closing up shop in the hotel, so it's basically trying to prove that the spirits actually exist in there in like this geeky ghost hunter kind of way, but they really use it effectively. There are long, long stretches of silence where, you know, what's her name? Sarah, I forgot her last name, unfortunately, but
Paxton.
Thank you, Sarah Paxton, where she's, you know, wandering around with a shotgun mic and the headphones on, trying to just pick up EVPs. And these scenes go on for like 4 or 5 minutes, and it's really effective. You're always waiting for a jump scare to come, but it never really does come. It's really just like caked in atmosphere. And it's a very methodical film, and I don't know if it's quite for everyone. I don't know if people are going in expecting something more like The Conjuring or whatever, but people aren't particularly kind to this film online, which is a goddamn shame, because it's really, really good, and I think it's really effective, especially the final shot of the film, which I don't want to give away, but it does still kind of play into the tone that is built up. And I also appreciate the fact that it doesn't take itself seriously, and there's actually a lot of camp comedy in it, and it's really, really effective.
Well, Ty West is actually one of my favorite filmmakers. I actually got the chance to ask him a question at Q&A up at TIFF when I saw a screening of his film, The Sacrament. I definitely understand the reaction to him and his films, because he's definitely more of an independent mind or whatever, and doing things. Sort of a lot of his films are much more slower paced and are sort of a throwback to a lot of the classic horror films, which is what I appreciate a lot about his films. So, you know, if you're interested in some sort of more obscure, outside of the box, more independent horror films, I definitely recommend him as a filmmaker, because The Innkeepers is sort of just the tip of the iceberg. But with that in mind, I'm going to transition to my two films that I've given the four slot, which, you know, I started with a sequel in the Halloween series, and now I'm going to transition to two sequels from two of the other more infamous slasher series. Sort of two of my recommendations. You know, I'm a big fan of watching these, you know, not all the films in the various slasher series are all that good, but there's always some sequels that are just a lot of fun to watch. And these are sort of two of my recommendations. The first one being A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, which is one of my favorites. Really entertaining. Just a lot of inventive Freddy Krueger kills. It's actually, I'll be honest, it's actually my favorite Nightmare on Elm Street movie, period. I actually prefer it to the first one, which most people won't say, but I just really like it because it's a lot of fun, very comedic, you know, there's really inventive, as I mentioned, kills with Freddy Krueger, some really fun stuff, but it also has this really weird concept of these kids banding together to fight off Freddy Krueger, and it's, I don't know, it just always gets me in sort of in the Halloween spirit, so I really enjoy it. And then the other film that's sort of sharing this slot for me is one of the entries from the Friday the 13th series, which I literally just rewatched last night, Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives, which is also my favorite Friday the 13th movie. I'll be honest, I don't think the first Friday the 13th movie is even good or remotely good. And I think Part 6 is my favorite, although a lot of people love Part 4 due to the Corey Feldman and Crispin Glover factor. I'm a big fan of Part 6 because it's basically the self-aware Friday the 13th movie in the series. It sort of uses sort of a classic monster movie send-up, but it's also, you know, constantly making jokes at its own expense and making fun of the various, you know, elements of the franchise, and that's sort of what I always enjoy. I'm a big fan of, you know, horror comedy in general, so I like when these slasher films don't take themselves too seriously and sort of make fun of themselves as they sort of go through the motions. And Jason Lives is definitely that film for me. So two sort of separate recommendations sort of tie in. You know, we got Halloween 3, then we got Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, and Part 6 of Friday the 13th, Jason Lives.
Well, to that end, I can also recommend Freddy vs. Jason, which is just more of that self-aware camp. It's not scary at all. It's just a lot of fun. I have not seen either of those films since, probably since I was a teenager yet again, when I kind of went on this binge of watching all the classic slashers that I couldn't when I was young. But I would say my favorite my favorite Nightmare on Elm Street film is actually Freddy's Dead Part 6, and I know, but it's only because they had the balls to use Freddy's Dead by Curtis Mayfield in the end credits, and I'll really just leave it at that. Moving on, my number three film is actually streaming now on HBO Go and HBO Now, and that's really the only good movie that David Koepp ever directed, Stir of Echoes, starring Kevin Bacon. You have not seen it. I really go out of your way because it's just a fun lit. It's basically Kevin Bacon is hypnotized by Ilana Glazer, and then all of a sudden you start seeing ghosts. It kind of got raked over the coals when it first came out because I think it was released like 2 months after Stir of Echoes, The Sixth Sense. And I really think that's an unfair parallel to draw because this is much more of a straight horror film. There are some really, really clever jump scares in here. And I did rewatch this film recently this week. I don't want to spoil any of the surprises, but it's just basically Kevin Bacon is trying to figure out why he is, who this ghost that he's continuously seeing is, and why she's reaching out to him.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the film, as I sort of alluded to off mic, but yeah, I mean, it could be interesting. I mean, I have never really heard anyone recommend Stir of Echoes before, so I might have to check it out. But moving on to sort of my number three, sort of my top three are a collection of some of my personal favorite horror films, but they're also some films that really do get me in the Halloween spirit. And this sort of third entry is Peter Jackson's Dead Alive or Brain Dead, whichever title you prefer, as it's referred to both on numerous occasions. This is sort of widely sort of regarded as one of the goriest films ever made, but it's again sort of not in a scary mold, but in a more comedic mold. And there really isn't much more to say about the film other than you have to experience this thing. Before Peter Jackson obviously became sort of a big blockbuster filmmaker with the Lord of the Rings films, King Kong, etc., he started making these very weird, New Zealand, Australian influenced horror films, and Dead Alive is definitely one of those. As I said, I can't really say much about it. You just have to go in and experience it, and I can't see how in any way if you got to take, you know, the gross out factor into effect, because there's lots of gross things that happen in the movie, but if you go in just hoping to be entertained, I don't see that there's any possibility that you won't be.
Oh, totally. It's just pure horror schlock goodness. And the ending sequence with the zombies, and I don't want to, if you haven't seen it, it's a pretty famous scene, but if you haven't seen it, really go out of your way to check it out if you're a gore hound. And as Andrew mentioned, it's really more, it's not scary. It's comedic. It's fun. Just go out of your way to watch it. What the hell ever happened to Peter Jackson? I know he did The Hobbit, whatever. We'll talk about that another time. My number two, so we're basically going to get into my two favorite horror films of all time, which are now streaming on Amazon Prime, both of these upcoming films. And for this, for number two on my list, it was actually remade into a film by Werner Herzog in the 70s, and is actually going to be remade by the director of the number one film on my list pretty soon, and that is F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu. But if you can't find it, that one currently is streaming on Amazon, but if you can find the Herzog version as well, that is very much worth going out of your way to watch as well. This is, you know, I've always had a fascination with this film based on, you know, its appearance in the kids' show Are You Afraid of the Dark, where the vampire was coming out of the screen and killing everyone in the theater. It just happened to be Nosferatu. It was fucking terrifying when I was a kid, and honestly, it's still creepy as shit now. You know, I watched the film a couple weeks ago, like 1 o'clock in the morning, drunk out of my mind, and I was pretty nervous going to bed that night, I'm not gonna lie. There's really haunting imagery, and the fact that it is done, that it is a silent film, and it's shot in these weird sepia tones, and, you know, the blue tinge for night, really just, and the fact that, like, just thinking this is actually, this was in the 20s, no one in this film is even alive anymore, it's really unsettling the way it just kind of digs in. It's all atmosphere, and some of the, you know, more famous shots in the film were actually kind of, were, you know, directly inspired some shots in other films, including Nightmare on Elm Street and the TV version of Salem's Lot from the 70s as well. It's really, I mean, going out on a limb and recommending a silent film, obviously it's an acquired taste nowadays, unfortunately, but I think you're doing yourself a disservice to not least give it a shot.
Oh, definitely, obviously, a film classic. And I've said to you previously that the Werner Herzog remake is actually one of my favorite films of all time. I'd even go so far to put it in my top 10 of all time. And although that version didn't make my list, it's definitely a really great horror film in general. But I love the classic F.W. Murnau version as well. But transitioning into my number two pick, this won't surprise anyone who knows my taste in horror films. It's yet another horror comedy. And it's probably, I'd say, the number one horror comedy ever made for me personally. It is Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 2, an absolute classic, entertaining as all hell, really funny. It's sort of a quasi remake slash sequel to the first film, which really gives it a sort of really weird effect where we're seeing some events sort of play out in sort of slightly different ways. But what I love about Evil Dead 2 is Sam Raimi fully embraces, you know, his love for the Three Stooges slapstick comedy. And obviously it goes without saying that Bruce Campbell as Ash Williams, you know, one of my favorite performances, period. I think it's, you know, in horror films are rare where they have such a great central performance that is so engaging and charismatic, and that's what Bruce Campbell gives in all of the Evil Dead films and continues to give in the Star series Ash versus the Evil Dead, which, if any of you haven't seen, I actually do recommend it because it actually continues a lot of that comedic and horror-infused stuff. But Evil Dead 2, an absolute classic. I mean, once again, sort of in the vein of Dead Alive or Brain Dead, I think it's a movie that's sort of very impossible to not be entertained by in some way, and it always gets me in the Halloween spirit. Just sort of a classic cabin in the woods tale, but just with insanity thrown in and anger cranked up to 11.
Oh, definitely. I honestly can't add anything beyond what you just said. It's really a classic. Go out of your way to watch it. And actually, since you mentioned Cabin in the Woods, why not watch Cabin in the Woods, too? Because it's actually a lot of fun. Both, it's a much more meta film, of course, but nonetheless very enjoyable. And number one on my list is a film that I've mentioned a few times on this podcast as being what I think is the scariest film ever made, bar none. And that's Robert Eggers' The Witch, which is currently, like I mentioned, streaming on Amazon Prime. Eggers will also be remaking Nosferatu. Hopefully that comes out sooner than later, because obviously that's pretty much just made for me. The Witch is another one of those, like, really nasty, no-holds-barred horror films that actually does the atmosphere really, really well. It's so basically in the first 5 minutes of the film, a baby is killed off, which is really ballsy for any horror film to touch. There's really, you know, nothing is sacred in this film. It's basically this Puritan family in the 1600s that's excised from their settlement because of religious differences with the, I'm assuming, whatever they called it back then, the governor or whatever. So they try to make their home away from that settlement in the woods, and they're being tormented and haunted by what they think is a witch, but there's really, like, this cat and mouse. I'll call it a cat and mouse game, and almost like a whodunit of whether or not the daughter of this family is actually the witch. And there really is no concrete answer by the end of the film. But I'd say the final 5 minutes is really the most terrifying thing that I've ever seen put on camera. And that's something that I don't really, you know, obviously I'm an atheist. I don't believe in paranormal or anything like that. But this film really, really shook me just because it does such a great job of building up that atmosphere. It's really eerie cinematography. And there's just, you know, there's so much that goes bump in the night that when it gets to that final denouement, it really is just unbelievably haunting, to the point where there was one night, I am not ashamed to admit, that I was actually afraid to go to the bathroom at like 3 o'clock in the morning just because it got to me that much.
Yeah, definitely one of the best horror films in recent memory in the last few years, and definitely a big recommendation from me. I sort of went in a completely different direction, much more of a sort of horror classic for my number one. I mean, obviously, I could have gone with the cliche of John Carpenter's Halloween, which is obviously a classic that we both love, and goes without saying that we both highly recommend it for Halloween season. But my number one is a film, a classic film directed by Dario Argento, a filmmaker who I've recently become incredibly obsessed with, and honestly, I might put him, he's definitely in my top 10 filmmakers, maybe on the edge of 5 right now, based on, you know, how I sort of dove into his filmography, particularly his sort of classic Italian giallo and slasher films. But this film is none other than Suspiria. It's a movie that I always try to watch every Halloween season. I haven't watched it yet, and it's currently actually being remade, although apparently it's going to be sort of a completely sort of different perspective, as has been revealed in recent interviews. But the thing about Suspiria that you have to understand is I honestly can't recommend it to everyone. I feel like it's a film that you've really got to be open-minded to experience. There isn't a whole lot of story to it. It's really all about the score, the atmosphere, the colors used, etc. It's all about just sort of the creepy, eerie atmosphere it creates. And it's very sort of, you know, artistically expressive in that way, using its colors, using its score by Goblin, which for me, I mean, it might be my favorite score of all time, period. I mean, that's saying something. With John Carpenter's Halloween score and various other ones that are definitely in contention. But I mean, from the opening sequence alone, every time I see the opening sequence of this movie, I immediately sort of get chills and is creeped out just through the use of lighting and the score, etc. But I mean, it's basically, you know, the story of this girl, this ballet dancer who happens upon this house, and then some weird things start to happen, and not everything is ever really completely explained or anything in the movie. But for me, it's just that movie that creeps me out more than anything else. And I think Dario Argento was a filmmaker who at that time period in time was working at the highest level. It definitely can't be said he's still doing that, but he had this great run of horror classics that I can't recommend enough. If you've seen Suspiria, I highly recommend checking out Deep Red, Tenebre, Phenomena, Opera, all of those films I'm a big fan of.
That's another film I probably haven't seen. I want to say I was probably like 19 or 20 the first time I watched it. That's another very, very affecting film, and it's pretty brutal. You know, even by 70s movie standards, it's fairly realistic. I don't want to give away the one scene in particular that I have in mind. But again, go out of your way to watch it. I don't even think it's on Blu-ray currently. If it is, it might be released in Europe, so you'd probably need a region-free player. But definitely go out of your way to check that out. And, you know, to close it out, I'll give one recommendation for Halloween Song, which is almost a horror movie in its own right, and that's Country Death Song by the Violent Femmes. And with that, we will turn our attention to next week, where we will be watching, where we'll be reviewing George Clooney's Suburbicon, which is really just getting shitty reviews. And I guess that's because of a queasy racial element that they try to bring into the film. But we will also be reviewing, in lieu of the other releases that are out this weekend, Netflix's Stranger Things 2.
Yes, and I'm definitely pumped. I stayed up late all last night to 3 a.m. when it was dropped and watched the first episode, which I was a big fan of. So that's sort of a tease. But I can't wait to sort of get through it later tonight. I'll probably be finished with it, if I'm being completely honest. But I'm really pumped for Stranger Things 2. And I think what's great about it is it doesn't really function as sort of a traditional TV series. In fact, their approach to it is more like a movie. So it sort of works for this podcast. But I mean, we're not going to pass up this opportunity to nerd out about Stranger Things season 2. So we'll be back with that and our thoughts on Suburbicon next week.
Thanks for listening, and happy Halloween.